Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. One article that a lot of people are reading now and sharing online is by the Hitler historian Ron Rosenbaum in the Los Angeles Review of Books. It's called Against Normalization, The Lesson of the Munich Post. Rosenbaum wrote Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil, that book, the latest edition published in 2014. He resisted facile comparisons between Hitler and Trump during the campaign, but it is decided that he now wants to warn the country of some very specific parallels that he feels are worth pointing out. Ron Rosenbaum joins me now. Thanks very much for doing this and for coming in the middle of a blizzard. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I'm glad to be here.
I guess I shouldn't use the technical term blizzard, which it's not in New York City. I think it is in Suffolk County. Here it's just really, really yucky out and really snowing and really windy. Your article is largely a telling of how the German democracy gradually normalized Hitler, allowing his rise to dictatorship. Is the Beer Hall Putsch of 1923 a good place to start?
I think it was a good place to start because there was an actual explosive fight between Hitler and the chief anti-Hitler newspaper in the 12 years of his rise in Munich, the Munich Post. I found a cache of their back issues that nobody had touched for years in the basement of an archive. And it told the story how in the middle of the Beer Hall Putsch, when Hitler could have taken over Bavaria and who knows Berlin, instead he dispatched his most experienced troops to pillage the anti-Hitler newspaper because he hated the press and particularly this newspaper so much.
And really the hero of your story is a newspaper, the Munich Post. What role did it play in pre-World War II Germany?
You know, I found that very few newspapers took Hitler seriously enough to dig into him, to investigate him, to find out the truth about him. And one thing the Munich Post found and published in December 9th, 1931, was a secret Nazi party plan for a final solution. They used the word final solution, Endlösung in German for the first time. And the rest of the papers dismissed him as a clown, as a fool. And I think that's the parallel, really. How does a democracy deal? Obviously, Trump is not genocidal, but how does a democracy deal with figures who are determined to crush democratic values and ideals and institutions?
You describe a moment after the election of 1932 when Hitler's party had the most members of parliament but not a majority, and the other right-wing parties formed a coalition with him, making him the figurehead and thus normalizing Hitler. And boy, does that sound to my ear like the Republican primary season when Trump had the most votes but not a majority, and then the party establishment normalized him enough to let him get the nomination when it was not certain for a while that they would do that. Is that comparison far-fetched?
Not at all. I was just reading a piece by Hitler's most recent biographer, and he quotes, "So many newspaper heads, institutional heads, corporate heads – who thought, we've got Hitler now. We've painted him into a corner. By making him chancellor, they thought the right-wing parties convinced themselves that he would be their puppet."
That's like saying, by making somebody president, we've really got him in a weak position now.
Exactly. It's shocking when you read it. But at the time, they thought they were really canny in doing so.
So in this instance, we had Reince Priebus, chairman of the party, who got rewarded for normalizing Trump during the campaign by being named chief of staff. and you got Jeff Sessions, who was confirmed as Attorney General last night, rewarded exactly for normalizing Trump. Remember when Trump was still seen as a fringy hater? Sessions became the first U.S. senator to endorse him. Now he's Attorney General. That's the context of these appointments, right?
Yes, and of course there's Steve Bannon, a white supremacist who has dragged in white nationalists, alt-right, neo-Nazi types, mainstreamed that kind of racist, anti-Semitic hatred.
But that's the trickle-down normalization. Reince Priebus and Jeff Sessions normalized Trump. Trump is normalizing Steve Bannon.
That's very true, yes.
And Priebus is serving that function even still, as he presents a kind of normal face to the press. And so is Sean Spicer, and so is Kellyanne Conway, who all go on TV to try to soften the edges of what Trump is actually saying to make him seem normal. That's a key part of their job, right?
Yes, and, you know, the press then has to supposedly be fair in treating these people who are tolerating racists. I mean, Sessions is a racist, and Bannon's people. Bannon going to the National Security Council over the Joint Chiefs of Staff is almost a kind of coup. And yet the press is faced with this dilemma of supposedly having to be fair to both sides. But what if one side is destroying or attacking democratic institutions like Trump is the judiciary recently?
But on the ongoing effort and need on the part of his aides to normalize Trump when he keeps doing such abnormal things. Trump says torture. Priebus says, don't worry, his defense secretary is against it. Trump says dishonest media. And Conway says, well, Jake, we have to be able to identify mistakes. Trump says Christian preference. He said it right on television. And Spicer says minority religions. Trump says Muslim ban and his lawyers write a travel timeout. It's all normalizing.
Yeah, you've got it. I mean, there are some writers and people in the media who are willing to speak out and say, no, this is not normal. This guy is a danger. But the obeisance to the idea of listening to both sides really gives the one side that has contempt for democracy an unfair advantage.
My guest is Ron Rosenbaum, who has an article in the Los Angeles Review of Books called Against Normalization, The Lesson of the Munich Post. You may know Ron Rosenbaum from any number of his books, including the one called Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil. We can take phone calls for Ron Rosenbaum at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And if you're just joining us, he's trying to point out some very specific parallels between the early days of the Trump presidency and the early days of Hitler in Germany, not to say that Trump is Hitler and make stupid comparisons, but make some real comparisons where they exist. And you suggest a comparison between Hitler and Trump in what you call the secret technique, a form of rhetorical control that you say both Hitler and Trump have used on people, especially the media. Can you describe the secret technique and give us some examples?
Well, I think it's a variation of the big lie. Hitler would, threaten violence. And then when he didn't get violent, German politicians would normalize him and be so grateful and consider Hitler a normal politician who should – for after the beer hall push, he was sentenced to 9 months in jail and he promised not to enter politics. But after a few years after he got out, he spent up in the mountains and without doing outrageous things, the German democracy decided he should be allowed to run for office again.
The shortest sentence in your article might be the most chilling. Democracy destroying itself democratically. Is that what happened in Germany?
I think that's definitely what happened in Germany, which the Weimar Republic had a parliament, the Reichstag. It had a party system, and Hitler was not considered an outlaw, a threat, and was allowed to run for office. And once he got into office, under the pretense of, oh, he's just going to be a puppet, a figurehead, it took him 2 months to get to martial law, ban all opposition, crush the press, and become the dictator that we know on the way to the final solution.
I want to make sure that we point out the limits of your analogies, because I think it's easy to hear people, and we could take callers all day, who say Trump is the next Hitler. And, you know, there's a point beyond which it's right to roll your eyes and say there's no evidence of that. So let's talk about the real differences so we can talk about the real similarities. Just looking at things in your article, Hitler had militias committing acts of violence from the 1920s. Hitler declared martial law. Hitler got the Munich Post, that newspaper, legally shut down. Hitler was bent on actual extermination of the Jews. So while the historical parallels are important, does crying Hitler still trivialize the Holocaust and sound hysterical in a way that actually doesn't help contain Trump?
My analysis really ends in March 1933, 2 months after Hitler took power. And at the time he announced martial law. So really I'm talking about the run-up to Hitler's dictatorship, not to the exterminationist later years. And so I think comparisons in the run-up. How did Hitler get into a position? And I think one reason is that the German people were compliant. I mean, in my story, I have a series of the final headlines of the Munich Post before they were crushed. And one of the final ones, I think the final one was, people allow themselves to be intimidated. And the German people did not resist Hitler. They continued to be fooled by him. While one heartening thing about the American people, I mean, I found myself genuinely heartened by the way people ran to the airports when the Muslim ban was announced. You know, we still have institutions that, like the judiciary, who are resisting Trump. And so I agree that Trump is not Hitler, but I feel that what he wants to be is an autocrat. And that's the comparison. The comparison that is also the question it poses to institutions like the press when dealing with a figure like Trump.
One heartening story today is that Trump's own Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, called Trump's attack on the judiciary disheartening and demoralizing. When I first heard the story last night, it was attributed to Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal after he had a meeting with Gorsuch, and I think, oh, okay, Democratic senator, and then they're going to deny it and dispute it. But then Gorsuch's own representative, former Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, confirmed it last night on MSNBC.
He did say that any comments from any source that didn't talk about the merits of a case but went to either the personal integrity or the independence of the judiciary, he found disheartening and demoralizing.
I thought that was extraordinary.
The judiciary seems perhaps our last best hope. And in a way, the Gorsuch statement suggests that if the Muslim ban gets to the Supreme Court, it's not a slam dunk for Trump because he doesn't want to be seen as a puppet for this guy, Trump, who has contempt for not just the judiciary but all democratic institutions.
One thing German history shows to you is how fragile democracy can be in the face of organized hatred.
I'm afraid that's true. It certainly was true of Germany. We're seeing this grand contest right now between a president who does not believe in democracy. No one can convince me he does. He has contempt for it. And between him and the judiciary, and between the people who are resisting him.
And you mentioned in your article journalists who right after the election declared a no-normalization stance. David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, Jamel Bowie at Slate, Charles Blow at The New York Times. But you say momentum is dissolving. The default position is normalization. What are you seeing?
Well, I think at the time I wrote that, that's what I was feeling. But looking back over the last 2 weeks, the Women's March, the millions of women took to the streets, the constant demonstrations, people who know are in touch with what's going on Capitol Hill say just about every representative is being picketed or demonstrated against at this time every single day. And it's having some effect in checking Trump and getting him to roll things back. Who knows? I think things are really teetering back and forth as to whether Trump will triumph or not.
Interesting. And because so much of your article is about the media, what does media non-normalization look like to you? I mean, it's one thing to be a columnist who takes a stance of, I'm not normalizing this guy, he's just too hateful, he's done this bigoted thing and that misogynistic thing, etc. A columnist, in a way, has the luxury of leaving it at that and continuing to enumerate the horrors. Should the larger media not evaluate each executive order on the details of its merits? Should the Democrats in Congress not vote for bills when they can advance their constituents' interest? What is it, other than doing what, in a way, the politicians and the media normally do, which is to call out extremism when it's there, build a firewall when it's needed, and report on everything else, too?
Here's the dilemma, I think. I think reporters, mainstream reporters, in a way, have done a great job in digging into Trump's scandals. There are so many out there, it's hard to keep track. That's part of the problem. And the other part of the problem is that people, a lot of people, 60 million people, don't seem to care. You know, I think ultimately it's not going to be editorial boards or columnists. It's going to be investigative reporters who will be the real heroes.
And here's how much non-normalization the media is doing, or at least one example of it. I played this yesterday too because I was so struck when I heard it. The opening of the CBS Evening News the other night, the staid, reserved CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley, this is 45 seconds of the first minute of the CBS Evening News Tuesday night.
It has been a busy day for presidential statements divorced from reality. Mr. Trump said this morning that any polls that show disapproval of his immigration ban are fake. He singled out a federal judge for ridicule after the judge suspended his ban, and Mr. Trump said that the ruling now means that anyone can enter the country. The president's claims, whether imaginary or fabricated, are now worrying even his backers, particularly after he insisted that millions of people voted illegally, giving Hillary Clinton her popular vote victory. There's not one state election official, Democrat or Republican, who supports that claim.
Wow. I heard that and I thought, holy moly, we have entered a new world if that's the beginning of the CBS Evening News.
Well, that was so great to hear. I had missed it. And one real difference between Trump and Hitler is that Trump seems a deranged mind who ordinarily would be considered a candidate for a mental institution, while Hitler was uncannily savvy and unfortunately didn't make a horrid spectacle of his plans until he had the power to carry them out.
My guest is Ron Rosenbaum, maybe best known for his book, Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil, the latest edition published in 2014. His new article in the Los Angeles Review of Books, Against Normalization, The Lesson of the Munich Post. And we'll continue with Ron Rosenbaum and take your phone calls for him right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the writer and Hitler historian Ron Rosenbaum, author of the new article that's being widely shared from the Los Angeles Review of Books called Against Normalization, The Lesson of the Munich Post. Neil in Park Ridge, you're on WNYC with Ron Rosenbaum. Hello, Neil.
Hi. My comment was, and you partially discussed national security and
you're referring to the time that Ron described when Hitler declared martial law, right?
Exactly.
And?
And I feel that, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it seems to me that Trump may be just waiting for one, even a minor terrorist attack, to declare that martial law, a national security crisis exists, that national and martial law may be necessary because the courts have just not allowed him to use the policies that he wants.
Well, we'll see what the courts allow him to do, and I think we're seeing in the last few days that it's not going to be easy for him to roll over the courts necessarily. But what about that hypothetical parallel with the past?
I think
when
that's
and if there is a terrorist attack.
I think that's a genuine nightmare scenario. I wouldn't rule it out. I'd hate to think that it's possible.
And it's a hypothetical, so we're going to leave it there and as something to keep an eye on, if God forbid. Herb in D.C., you're on WNYC. Herb, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of Paul Ryan, who seems to me to be practicing a form of incremental normalization, in that when questioned on some of Trump's more outrageous statements like the Muslim ban, will say, I'm totally against that, or you shouldn't be attacking judges. And by sort of taking the moral high ground on some of these issues and then just remaining completely silent on others, he seems to say, well, I don't have to agree with everything he says, just the way I don't agree with everything that Obama says. But he's our elected president, and I can work with him. I find that the most insidious of all the forms of normalization. But I'd like to hear your comments.
I think that's well said. I mean, I think Ryan is a kind of key character in the question of normalization, because every time Trump will say something like, he didn't know David Duke, he doesn't really know what the KKK does, or things like that, and people will come to Ryan, he would sort of dismiss it, and yes, I think that's exactly his function, what you've described.
Tracy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tracy.
I think that the media needs to recognize that Trump has filled his cabinet with neo-Nazi skinhead militia people who are very ready to step in and create some kind of an action that will require martial law in the eyes of people who are sitting and twiddling their thumbs, not accepting what's going on, wanting to listen or realize it. And people like Paul Ryan, who's only half there as a human being, are very willing to let the half of him that wants to be in the media, be in the forefront, just like Trump, let all this stuff happen. Because they don't care about human beings, democracy, or anything else, which our country is founded on. And we need to stand up and take account and not be silent, which is great that everyone's protesting everything. But we need to have people in the media, which is great that CBS News, it was NBC or CBS, said that.
CBS.
We cannot stand by and let this happen. It's very clearly happening, whether it's intended or not. Steve Bannon, Sessions, those are people who do not have democracy at heart.
Tracy, thank you very much.
I think it's interesting that and well-founded that people focus on people like Paul Ryan as a symbol of normalization. And I think history will look back upon them and see them as shameful and stained.
David Frum, who was on Indivisible with Charlie Sykes here last night, the former Bush speechwriter David Frum, suggested that Trump doesn't have to shut down opposition media like Hitler did or Putin did. He just has to discredit them in the eyes of enough people with his constant attack on the mainstream media as dishonest and fake news to have the same effect.
Well, I think one of you know, as I was talking just now, it reminded me that one of Hitler's techniques was to use Goebbels to single out individuals in the media and attack them. Goebbels made the Jewish chief of police of Berlin as a constant target of mockery and venom. And you notice that almost all of Trump's attacks are on individuals, and it's a kind of intimidating thing. People don't want to be the focus of that, and it's just one more dispiriting aspect of this reign.
And you describe in your article how Hitler was a master of bluffing to get himself normalized, like pretending sometimes to be a feckless Charlie Chaplin-esque clown, other times to be a sleeping serpent, as you put it, other times a statesman. The Weimar establishment didn't know what to do with him, so they normalized him.
Well, you know, I'm sort of obsessed with the misapprehension of Hitler created by Charlie Chaplin's Great Dictator. It came out in 1940 and it was supposed to be really anti-Hitler, but really it made Hitler a comic figure, and it fed into what historians have come to call the underestimation syndrome. He looked foolish in his lederhosen and his stupid salutes and things like that. And people didn't realize he had tanks and entire armies moving into the Rhineland and the Sudetenland, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, this may be a reach, but is the seven-nation travel ban a kind of non-military Sudetenland? At least potentially. In other words, if Hitler first took something that you could kind of justify because a lot of Germans there wanted it, blocking people from seven objectively terror-infected countries as the first act is a foot in the door to normalizing a bigger project?
Well, I would agree. I think that he's done it so badly that it discredits that attempt, which is good, and the judiciary, you know, are heroic in resisting it too.
Another thing that David Frum brought up last night is that the backlash to Trump risks discrediting itself if it goes too far. So they were talking about the example of violence on the Berkeley campus last week when, Milo Yiannopoulos from Breitbart was scheduled to speak. And so the opposition looks more dangerous than those in power, and they get, you know, neutralized as a result. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I think that's like overestimating and overthinking. There are always going to be extremists, and even in a righteous opposition movement, but looked at objectively, a few Berkeley anarchists are no counterweight to the President of the United States, the National Security Council, and the U.S. nuclear arsenal.
Jonathan in Inwood, you're on WNYC with Ron Rosenbaum. Hi, Jonathan.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you for having me on. I just had a quick question, and then if you'll allow me, I'd like to follow it up after your response.
What do you think this is, the White House press briefing?
my question is this. I've listened to you guys talking here today, and basically what I'm getting from you is that we are drawing parallelisms between the rise of Hitler, but we are stopping before we go into the period when the Third Reich begins starting the Second World War. Now, to me, that's kind of like a math equation that says 0 + 0 = 0. So here's my question. What are you ultimately alluding to is going to happen here? What do you see happening from this rise that you find parallelisms with the rise of Hitler in?
Well, you're talking about Hitler after 1933, and will Trump turn into that kind of autocrat? And I'm just afraid I can't answer that question. My magic eight ball does not give me an answer. I dread the possibility. I don't think Trump has the genocidal hatred of Jews that Hitler did. Trump just is more self-aggrandizing than hating others.
Jews wouldn't be his first target, presumably. The question is, does he have the genocidal hatred of others?
Yes, exactly. He has a hatred of those who don't worship him.
But I don't want to ascribe genocidal feelings to Trump when we haven't seen that.
I don't feel he has a genocidal ideology. I don't think he has any ideology at all except self-aggrandizement.
It's one of the most interesting parts of your article to me was that you used to believe Hitler believed in nothing and just use bias against the Jews to rise to power. That's how a lot of people see Trump today. But you eventually became convinced that anti-Semitism was always a core belief.
Well, the initial belief was Alan Bullock, the Oxford historian who wrote the first Hitler biography and said he was a mountebank who didn't really believe in anything. Bullock changed his mind and said, incorporated the belief of H.R. Trevor Roper that Hitler's anti-Jewish ideology was central to him. I think there's some combination with Hitler, but I think with Trump, it's more what Bullock says. That
Jonathan, I didn't forget my promise to you for a follow-up question, but we've got like 30 seconds in the segment. Go.
Okay, so here's my comment about this. This seems kind of be, and I don't know if this is necessarily what's going on during this conversation right now, but I'm just going to go ahead and say this. Ever since Gore Vidal called William F. Buckley Jr. a crypto-Nazi in the 1968 U.S. presidential election, it seems like that is a go-to below-the-belt type of attack for liberals on conservatives. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that Trump is a conservative. What he's kind of done is piggyback off of the conservative movement. However, what I am saying is that equating his rise here in America to the rise of Hitler, I'm sorry, I don't agree with that. And here's why. You made a comment that Trump was kind of mentally unstable and Hitler was a very savvy politician. I think it's actually the exact opposite. If you read a book called In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson, which tells the story of William Dodd, the American ambassador in Berlin from 1933 to 1937, you very much get the idea and the notion that the Nazis were completely insane. They were the most evil force to march across the face of the planet in modern history.
And Jonathan, I'm going to leave it there. Forgive me for time. But you get his point, and there is a risk of overreach in any conversation like this.
Well, you know what I found? Everyone has their own personal theory of Hitler, and they stick to it, and I certainly, if you read my article, which I doubt this listener has, you'll see that I don't equate Trump with Hitler in any way. I examine the question they pose for a democracy.
Ron Rosenbaum, author of the book Explaining Hitler, the latest edition published in 2014, is now the author of an article in the Los Angeles Review of Books called Against Normalization, the Lesson of the Munich Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on, Brian.